It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. You might just as well see her on her PBS programs or unexpectedly dropping in and chatting with customers at her Pittsburgh restaurant. She's best-selling author, Emmy Award winner, restaurateur, celebrity chef, Lydia Bastianich. I sat down with her when she was in Pittsburgh recently. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. Buongiorno.
18 years ago, long before Pittsburgh had become a foodie city, you decided to invest in our local restaurant scene. Did you have any ties to Pittsburgh before then, other than people watching you and seeing you on PBS?
Well, yes. Pittsburgh is the PBS in Pittsburgh is a strong station for me. That meant that people were watching. 18 years ago, we looked at Columbus, Ohio, and then Pittsburgh. And we love Pittsburgh. I love Pittsburgh because of the water, the rivers, the bridges. The position that we chose was a little risky.
The location in the Strip District.
Absolutely.
Why was it risky? People coming there? Was there enough other business that might attract people to say, oh, I'm going to go to dinner at Lydia's?
Well, what I liked about it was the street, the macaroni company,
right,
and all of that.
Penny.
So, that was an active street. I said, well, here people come. They're interested in food. So I liked the area. The risky part was that it was not a residential area. There was not much commerce going on in this area at that time. But I said, you know what? People will travel. We were not too far from downtown, not too far from the arts. That's right. Also very important for a restaurant. And we said, okay, we got a good real estate deal. And I said, okay, let's open up. People will travel. And it took a while. It was a slow uphill kind of growth.
When you started Lydia's in Pittsburgh, let's face it, there were plenty of Italian restaurants in Pittsburgh. What did you want to offer that was maybe different than the usual fare?
Well, we are known for there's the Italian-American food, and that's wonderful food. And, we have some of those recipes, but we are known for regional Italian cooking. Now, Italy has 20 regions, and, if you travel through Italy, each region has different food, and it's quite different than the Italian-American food that is served here. So I thought that we wanted to really bring the Italian culture. I feel like a conduit for my Italian, the birth country, and my adoptive country, America. So that's what we really want to bring and continue to bring, that sensibility, that Mediterranean sensibility of eating good, healthy, seasonal food.
You mentioned earlier that sort of the location at the beginning might have been a bit of a risk, but what about the menu offering something different? People say, oh, it's a new Italian restaurant. I'll go expecting the traditional American Italian fare. Was that a risk?
Kevin, you take that in consideration when you open a restaurant. We did our diligent research. What were the popular Italian restaurants and what was their menu like? And what were the strong items? And we still have some of those on the menu. You absolutely, it's the Italian-American cuisine is a delicious cuisine. So we absolutely did. We incorporated whether we have the chicken parmigiana, we have the stuff, the eggplant parmigiana, the stuffed mushrooms, all of these things, fritto misto, all of these things are part of the Italian-American and Italian culture. So we still have those. But then we have also stuffed cabbage. We have even tripe and pasta. We are really known for a pasta. We have a specialty, like three pasta, symphony of pasta. And you can make that a meal where we come out with three different pastas and you can have as much of each. And that really reflects like one would eat in Italy. The pasta, the seasons. Now we're going to have peas, artichokes, favas, all of that springy stuff coming in. So absolutely, combine and continue to bring ever more the traditional Italian seasonal menu as it is in Italy. And then with some of the favorites, shall we say, the local favorites.
You have founded how many restaurants over the course of your business career?
Well, now as a family, we have 18 restaurants.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned earlier Kansas City, of course, a few in New York City,
right.
Pittsburgh, other cities, LA, Las Vegas, et cetera. What is your approach to sort of growing your business without overextending yourself and, you know, in a sense, threatening the overall business approach?
Kevin, it's all about the team. It's all about the people that work with us. So what's important for us is to nurture and to energize and to kind of mentor a lot of the talent. Now, when I'm finished right here with you, I'm going to go right into Lydia's. I'm going to go in the kitchen and I'm going to work with Chef Daniel and every one of those, kind of sharing with them, you know, all the years of experience that I have. And that's the magic, is to develop a symphony, a positive energy and delicious food. And that sort of goes into the dining room too, the management, you know, how to treat people, welcome them. You know, restaurant, it's a very special place where people want to be welcome, people want to be recognized, people are nurtured there. So it's not a solitary trip. Each restaurant has its own, crew, its own team that makes it successful.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is restaurateur, celebrity chef Lydia Bastianich. I mentioned earlier that many customers to your Pittsburgh location have seen you at your restaurant. You don't live in Pittsburgh, so why is it important for you to show up, be physically present, and not just checking on the bottom line, if you would?
Because these are my customers, these are my friends, you know, that have followed me, whether they follow me on PBS, buy my books, buy my wine, sauces, and they become, I am responsible to them. I want to see them. I want to thank them. They need to see who is Lydia. So I come periodically. We'll have dinners, you know, thematic dinners, right, where I walk the room and I talk to everybody, whether I sign my books, take pictures with them, the chef will come out. So it's very important that the restaurant, if it has my name, that there is a Lydia and the Lydia is there.
You've done multiple TV series, including Lydia's Italian Table and Lydia's Kitchen. Did you get your TV break when you were a guest of another celebrity chef, Julia Child?
Well, what happened, Kevin, was that in 1981, I opened my first restaurant in 71. Then 10 years later, we opened Felidia in New York City. And there is where I really began to be the chef and cook a regional Italian recipe. So I cooked polenta and risottos, all of these things that were not yet much on Italian menus. And Julia Child and James Beard walked in because they heard this woman cooking. And Julia Child was interested in risotto, mushroom risotto. She ordered it. She loved it. She wanted me to teach her how to cook it. So we became friends. She came over the house. And ultimately, she invited me to be on her show. And I did two episodes of the Master Chef series. And the producer says, you know, Lydia, you're pretty good. How about a show? And she encouraged me. So I must say that she did absolutely introduce me, encouraged me, and mentored me along those first years.
Many celebrity chef-backed restaurants have closed in recent years. Some say that probably expanded too fast. We were talking about extensions. Some fielded the complaints of high prices with little in the way of personal touch. And we've talked about your personal touch. Some say it's just the economy. Has Lydia's felt any pinch to the purse strings in recent years due to any of those factors?
I think, you know, it's a business. And at the end of any business, at the bottom line has to be in line. The percentages, the costs, the food costs, the labor costs. So that's the business. That's the non-romantic part of running restaurants, shall we say. And certainly my daughter Tanya and Joseph are really good at that. So, yes. How we felt? Yes, we felt the pinch like everybody else, and you make the appropriate adjustments. But never forfeiting the value for the customers, the product, to be honest and direct. So I think what has been our overall riding factor was the food that we cooked.
Mario Batali, a longtime business partner of yours, exited that partnership in March after several allegations of sexual misconduct. Has that shakeup affected your corporate culture?
Absolutely. You know, there's an awareness now more than ever. But although I was, you know, I'm a woman, and I was always conscious of a woman's place in our industry.
What do you mean by a woman's place?
You know, the toughness that we hear all about, and you know, maybe the mishandling of women in our industry. Our industry, the restaurant industry, is a tough industry in its own. Long hours, hard work in there, and it's under pressure. And so it has all those elements kind of that are. So, and you need to really work and manage with caution that everybody kind of fits in, that the business continues to grow, that the customer is treated right, but also that the workers are treated correctly and they have a place. And specifically the women. And what I, you know, I speak to a lot of women. I am the founder also of Women Chefs and Restaurateur 15 years ago, where my consciousness of women in the kitchen needed attention, I felt. And when I speak to organizations or events, I get asked that question, Lydia, how about the women? What do you think? Well, you know, I tell them really honestly how I feel, and that is that our profession is a profession. So men or women, gender, just make sure that you invest in yourself and that you are the best that you can be at what you do, the best chef and the whatever, and you go out there and you make it happen. Gender at that point, you know, just put it aside. When you're in there and working, respect everybody and demand respect. Mm-hmm. So invest in yourself and respect.
But let's face it, some men don't put gender aside. But Tali, one of many in the restaurant world who have been accused of harassment and assault in the wake of Me Too, have you started to see, or are you hoping for some industry-wide changes as a result of women speaking out?
Oh, absolutely. And it's great to see. I think the time had really come for women to speak out and have their voice heard. And I see the consciousness of chefs in restaurants. Absolutely. This has been a resounding period for us women in the industry, and it's only going to get better.
Lydia, we've been talking about developing menus and what you're trying to accomplish. In the larger sense, culturally speaking, what does food mean to you?
Oh, my goodness, you're touching my heart now. Food is, I think, to all of us, you know, the one common denominator that we all have, no matter what race, no matter where you come from in this world, is food. We all eat. We all need to nurture ourselves. And so food is the direct line of communication, I feel, between people, not only between families. You know, you sit, certainly, I think that at the end of my show, I always say, tutti a tavola mangiare, everybody to the table, let's sit down and let's eat. But that applies also when you meet a stranger. If you share food, the door opens. And you know when you're giving somebody food, it's positive. You want their well-being. You want to nurture them. You know, it's not so. Food is positive. It's a venue. It's a road, a highway to opening doors of discussions and positive. And you know, I think that it should be food diplomacy, to tell you the truth.
Some of our listeners might not know the early part of your story. You're a refugee. Came to America. When you came to America, what were your hopes? What were your goals?
Well, Kevin, I have to explain a little bit. So I was born in a part of Italy that's no longer Italy. So if you up by Venice, underneath Austria, now it's Slovenia. There's a little peninsula called Istria. That was Italy. World War II came, Italy lost the war, and that part was given, that and part of Dalmatia was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia. I was young, just born at that time. The Iron Curtain went down. We were caught behind the Iron Curtain. It was tough because we couldn't use our name. We couldn't speak Italian. We couldn't go to church. Ultimately, my parents decided that they wanted to go back to the free world, Italy. Right. But we weren't allowed. We had to literally escape. We got back into Italy, and we had some relatives in Italy. But in order to be kind of put our credentials in line, we were put in a political refugee camp for right. 2 years. And so when I was 12, we finally got the opportunity to have a visa to come to the United States. Dwight Eisenhower was the president, 1958, I remember. So as a 12-year-old, coming to the United States, for me, it was an opportunity like no other in the world, having kind of escaped, not having a home, having lived in a refugee camp, not unlike what's happening today, you know, very parallel. And ultimately, you know, mine is the American success story of an immigrant.
So with many restaurants, best-selling books, TV shows, I assume that you've exceeded those original goals when you came to America.
Absolutely. I say, you know, I did not set goals for myself. I think what my growth and I was enthusiastic of the opportunities that were coming along. And I took the ones that I thought I could fulfill. And that was, you know, it's from developed from one to another, one restaurant and two restaurants, then more, then the cookbook opportunity, then the television opportunity. And now continuing ever more, actually, to share my passion with others that they might grow into. But Kevin, there is no place in the world that I could have done this. There's no place like America in the whole world. And I am the living proof that if you're given a chance, you can make it here in America, certainly.
Restaurateur, celebrity chef, and more, Lydia Bastianich, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon University are working on artificial intelligence to help surgeons in planning cardiac operations, but they say the goal is to make that intelligence unremarkable. A rush of investment could be headed for Pittsburgh thanks to a new way to avoid paying capital gains taxes. It's called Opportunity Zones, and there are still plenty of questions about how they'll work. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence. I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Benedum Center downtown hosts the first Gene Kelly Awards for Excellence in High School Musical Theater in 1991. The annual celebration highlights the talents of nearly 30 Pittsburgh-area high school productions at three budget-based levels. Much like the Tony Awards, the Gene Kellys recognize all elements of musical theater, including the young actors, orchestras, lighting, and costume design. After a week-long boot camp, student performers from participating high schools come together and put on a finale for the annual awards gala. Winners are invited to attend the National Awards Competition in New York City. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A Penn Avenue storefront in Pittsburgh's Garfield neighborhood is home to Boom Concepts, a workspace and art gallery created by online magazine publisher Thomas Agnew and co-founder Daryl Kinsel. Agnew tells 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort, the venture serves as a showcase for up-and-coming artists.
We work with a lot of young and older individuals to present a different series of exhibitions every month. And we also provide professional development help, you know, artist development help.
Such as what?
You know, outside of us just what we normally do, you know, we post the events and on our social media, send an email blast out. We try to talk to them about different ways that they can promote and connect with different individuals. We try to give them access to some of the people that we have. And, you know, people that we are connected to are also trying to see different things that's going on in the space. So I think having that network and teaching others how to like build a network and connect with people also helps them out in the long run. We've had a lot of different music type of showcases where we try to connect people with the right folks to kind of make a move. Really trying to help them out, and their outreach is the biggest part. You know, we could just say, oh, we're renting a space and pay us the money and that's it. You know what I mean? But we try to at least be on them, like, hey, do you have a flyer? Are you sending out a press release? Where are you posting these things at? Are you going out in the community and other parts of the community and talking to other individuals, other artists, and trying to bring them in? Are you really utilizing your network instead of just saying, hey, we're throwing an event and waiting until the event and the event happens? So we try to do a lot of different small professional development pieces to help the artists out.
How do you help young artists?
We just want to see everybody be successful. So I think just being able to utilize our network, utilize our skill set, try to pass that down, because just holding on to those things doesn't matter at the end of the day. You know, you got to pass that off, trying to help the youth. So I think I've seen a spike in the youth being able to kind of just change their ways, be more business-minded, be more successful in the ways that they wanted to do, start going after grants. That was the same thing about me. I didn't know about grants, but now I'm passing that information down to other people. Like, hey, go grab these grants that are available. We're trying to make sure that there's an opportunity for all to go out in the world and make money off of, you know, their skill set, their creativity. So when there's call for artists for certain things, we make sure that we tell our network, hey, you need to be checking out these call for artists. You need to let them know that you're out here. You need to let them know that you are creative and you deserve to be picked also.
After 5 years, are you where you thought you would be in connection with this project?
Going from a workspace to what we are now, I mean, we're still a workspace. I still work out of here every day almost, and being able to get that work done, but also having that other component of being able to help other individuals, yeah, it's been great.
Thomas Agnew, co-founder of Boom Concepts, thank you for taking time to do this interview.
Thank you.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. You hear artificial intelligence, AI, and you might say that's beyond my comprehension or that's remarkable. But researchers at Carnegie Mellon University's Human-Computer Interaction Institute might prefer we get to a point that we think that it's not so remarkable. John Zimmerman is Tang Family Professor of Artificial Intelligence and Human-Computer Interaction at CMU. Welcome to The Confluence.
Hi, happy to be here.
So what exactly does unremarkable mean in the context of AI?
So this is an idea we take from Peter Ptolemy, who noted, like, electricity is unremarkable. We all appreciate it, but we don't notice it until it's missing. And so we're interested, particularly in the health domain, how do we situate AI so that it's valuable for clinicians, but it's not something that they have to think about?
Artificial intelligence, you can tell us, is used in so many fields. What is your approach into incorporating AI into the field of medicine?
So the project that I've been working on recently is working on a system that helps cardiologists decide when they should implant a mechanical heart. And what the literature tells us is researchers do a great job of making decision support systems that can accurately make medical predictions. But when these systems move from the lab to the clinic, they generally all fail, and they fail because clinicians won't use them. And so in our work, we spend a lot of time in the clinic observing how decisions get made, understanding the social processes, and then we really look for what is the right time and place to offer an AI insight on a patient, so that we can have just the right influence on the decision being made.
So failure because of lack of use, is it a trust issue? What is it?
I think to a large part, it's a perception of value. So the engineers that have been building this system work with an assumption that doctors know they need help, that they will approach a computer system in their free time and engage with it to discover what they should do for a patient. And our observations of clinicians is they're highly confident in what they're doing, and they have absolutely no free time to go and do something in addition to the work that they're already doing. And so we really focus on how we can situate this additional piece of information in the workflow they already use and sort of at just the right moment.
I want to follow up on what you said, the assumption that they know they need help. I mean, physicians and surgeons have to show, I would say, a level of command, of confidence, especially for their patients. How do you make it so using AI is not challenging their ability to make decisions?
So this is really why we're after this concept of unremarkable. And the way we've done it for this specific case is we automate the creation of slides they use for their decision meeting. And then we place a predicted survival curve, like will this patient survive this surgery over time? And generally, you know, as they're going through the meeting, talking about the individual patients that may or may not get an implant, they work very quickly. And in most cases, the situation really is textbook. And the experience these clinicians have with the hundreds of patients they have seen give them great insight and great confidence in the decisions that they're making. The advantage of an AI system is it can have the experience of hundreds of thousands of cases. So it can see things that happen very infrequently, but notice those patterns. And what we're looking for is a situation where our clinicians are very confident they want to do something, but the AI system is giving a different signal. And we're just trying to create a tiny bit of friction in those cases to get the clinicians to slow down and reconsider what they're planning to do.
So it's all in the planning process. It's not in sort of the spur of the moment actual medical process.
No. It's very much in the planning of the decision. Very little surgery like takes place without a long lead time.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin, and we're speaking with researcher and professor John Zimmerman from CMU's Artificial Intelligence and Human-Computer Interaction Institute about how AI could assist planning for certain heart surgeries. Is it sort of the surgeon sort of benefits not only from his or her own experience with such procedures, but, you know, sampling or using AI's experience in studying all kinds of similar cases, but more so?
So in general, the clinicians today have a lot of experience, and they a junior physician has attending seniors that have the experience, and those are the people they go to when they are unsure of what to do, and there's a lot of collective human decision making. And the other thing I should stress is the AI always has a very incomplete view of any individual patient. It knows what's in the medical record, but it does not know all of the information that's not in that record that clinicians have access to. So issues of like, does a patient have a family that can take care of them post-surgery, that can really be there to nurture them, both, you know, physically, but socially, mentally? That's going to have a lot to do with how a patient does, and that's information the AI simply has no access to. So we're really viewing what the AI provides as simply one piece of information among a whole bunch of factors that clinicians consider when making these life and death choices.
What sort of reaction are you getting now from physicians and from surgeons?
Interestingly, their reaction is non-hostile. they're not super excited about this, but they don't see it as distracting or getting in their way or challenging, and that's different than previous systems. Where we have seen great acceptance is in the group we call the mid-levels, the nurse practitioners and the social workers, who generally have a lot more touch time with each individual patient. And while they're making a group decision with the attending physician, there's a huge power imbalance. And so most of them are very unwilling to challenge a doctor on a choice they've made. And what this does by sort of putting up information that might go against what the doctor wants to do is it provides someone at the mid-level with a way of challenging, but not challenging based on their own expertise. They can simply say, why do you think the survival prediction is not good for this patient? It's disturbing the social balance a little, but sort of just in those moments where this patient might actually benefit from slowing that decision down.
And the point is, the physicians can still not accept the advice of AI. They're not bound to it, correct?
Correct. And it's very hard to see what the future will be, but I suspect that clinicians that basically override the AI decisions and have bad outcomes open themselves up to other problems.
How do you suggest maintaining the balance between the AI advice that can be ignored and judgments that seem maybe a little too controlling?
I really think we want to keep all of these decisions in the hands of people. The AI is making a statistical calculation. That's very different from a human decision. And again, what this is really trying to do is predict survivability. The clinician also really needs to have the discussion with the patient. Do they want to live with this? What is the, what is the quality of life that they're seeking? And the AI is not going to do any of that. And the AI is not going to be there with the patient if they have a bad outcome, but the doctor will be. So again, we really see this as a supplement to help with decision-making, like any other sort of measures they might get of vital signs. It's just another piece of information they can factor in.
And finally, Professor, what are your next steps on your particular project?
I would say, like, my work is much more fundamentally focused on how we can get people to envision products and services that leverage the power of AI. And so more and more I'm focusing on practitioners in the innovation space, but healthcare is definitely one of those. How can we get them to recognize opportunities where AI can add value?
John Zimmerman is Tang Family Professor of Artificial Intelligence and Human-Computer Interaction at Carnegie Mellon University. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh and other locales across Pennsylvania could see a rush of investment thanks to a new way to avoid paying capital gains tax by creating what are called opportunity zones. Margaret J. Krause is WESA's development and transportation reporter, and she's been looking at the potential impact. Margaret, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So, opportunity for whom and for what?
Well, that depends. The idea is there are lots of places in the U.S. that haven't seen investment or economic development in many, many, many years. And the hope is to encourage investors to put their money into these places and keep it there. So hopefully opportunity for low-income communities across the United States.
It's a federal program. Briefly, what is the role of the state, and then how does it get to the local level?
Sure. So opportunity zones were enshrined in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017. So it's in the IRS. It's in the federal tax code.
Okay.
States were required, the chief officers of states and U.S. territories were required to nominate areas that would then be certified by the U.S. Secretary, sorry, the U.S. Department of the Treasury,
right.
So the Secretary of the Treasury. So the state, its role was to nominate and say, these are the ones we think really qualify and could use some help. And then going forward, states can create other regulations to govern how these operate, but Pennsylvania hasn't done that yet.
How long would the developer, the recipient of this tax break, not have to pay the taxes?
Okay, so I actually want to take a moment to clarify.
Okay.
Developers are not really receiving a tax break.
All right.
That's why this program is somewhat different. So with the opportunity zones, you and I, if we have, we decide, I'm going to sell a stock. I don't have any stocks to sell.
Okay.
But so I sell a stock and I gain money. The federal government says, ooh, money. I would like some of that. And so they tax it. Me, I would say, well, I don't want to pay the capital gains tax. I don't really need this money right now. I'm going to reinvest it. I'm going to reinvest it in this opportunity zone fund. Only qualified opportunity funds can invest in qualified opportunity zones. I'm still working on an analogy. But what happens is within these zones, a fund could either invest in physical things such as a building, a factory, any number of things, or a business. So the developer may receive assistance, but they're not receiving the tax break. They're receiving the benefit of this tax incentive.
All right. We got it.
Okay, cool.
We've got it. About how many zones, you mentioned Pennsylvania nominated, about how many in Pennsylvania or in the Pittsburgh area, and are they in competition with one another?
Let's start with where they are. There are more than 8,700 opportunity zones across the United States. Pennsylvania, there were 1,200 qualifying zones. 300 are designated opportunity zones. There are 27 census tracts in the city of Pittsburgh. They don't correspond exactly with neighborhoods. And, sorry, what was the second question?
Are they in competition with one another?
No, they are not in competition. The idea, well, certainly not state to state. It may be that neighborhoods may vie for various funders to fund them, but they're not directly in the competition market isn't the way we might normally think of it.
Okay. Locally, what sort of neighborhoods, what sort of census tracts are we talking about that are interested and qualified?
There are a number in Allegheny County. I forget exactly how many in Allegheny County. In Pittsburgh, Hazelwood falls into one of the designated opportunity zones, as do parts of the Hill District, Homewood, Larimer, Lincoln, Lemington, Belmar. So there actually hasn't been a ton of discussion about opportunity zones in Pittsburgh, which is why the Hill CDC held a forum 2 weeks ago, and it was really the first dive into this discussion.
And one of the people, I believe, who talked at that forum was developer Irvin Henderson.
It still has to be controlled by local ordinances, by local community groups, by local processes.
So what are the concerns here? Gentrification, we've seen that crop up before in development.
Here and nationally, gentrification is one of the persistent concerns with opportunity zones. Will this really help people who live there, long-term residents, or will it push them out? Mr. Henderson's point was that this is not the federal government stomping in and saying this is exactly how it's going to go. His point was it's incumbent on state governments, local governments, to specify, if they feel there's a need, how it should go. So he's saying, you know, you're not going to be able to go around Pittsburgh's zoning. You're not going to be able to go around, you know, if a neighborhood has a master planning document, you can't just go around that. However, I asked him after the forum, I said, well, it sounds like that means that development in these opportunity zones are vulnerable to the pitfalls of whatever the local ordinance is, whatever the local zoning. Right. He said, yeah, they are. So it's something to be really aware of.
What about the level of success? Here again is developer Irvin Henderson.
Remember that this is about investment returns and impact, okay? It's not impact alone. You've got to show investment returns.
Investment returns. So what he was saying there is that, yes, this opportunity zones may very well be a vehicle for impact, for creating new jobs, new opportunities in places that really need it. But every member on the panel that was organized by the Hill CDC was clear to say what opportunity zones are, they are a tax incentive. This is a new shelter for wealth to not be taxed by the federal government. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, but that in order for it to be successful, people who want the funds to invest in them, either their business or their physical infrastructure, need to show that as a business, they'll make money and provide a return to investors.
Just in a couple of sentences, Margaret, what's next? What are you going to be looking for answers to?
Oh, so many things. There are concerns not just about gentrification, but if using the federal poverty level as a guideline to create these zones is really the most effective. From 2011 to 2019, there's been a ton of change in terms of where poverty and wealth reside. So that's one thing I'm interested in. And also just how will they measure success? How will locally, how will we begin to prepare for this kind of investment?
Margaret J. Krause is WESA's development and transportation reporter. Margaret, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Tuesday, is primary election day in Pennsylvania. Here in the Pittsburgh area, longtime office holders might be facing their toughest challenges to date. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovic, Julia Maruka, and Mick Stanelli. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.